to the Pulteney Street Podcast. I'm your host, President Joyce Jacobson. Today, my guest is Jim Cicery, a member of the Hobart Class of 1991 and the founder and owner of two of Geneva's newest and most interesting shops, FLX Goods and Vinifera, both located on Linden Street in brick-and-mortar storefronts and online. With these and some other planned ventures, Jim intends to create the Amazon of the Finger Lakes, becoming the single largest distributor of quality products made right up here in upstate New York. It's a really novel idea and one that I am excited to learn more about. Prior to returning to Geneva, Jim had a successful finance career working for firms such as J.P. Morgan, BNY Mellon, Vanguard Group, and Strayer Education. He holds an MBA from Duke University and earned a certificate in international business from NYU. We're going to talk today with Jim about the nature of his career to date, how he landed back in Geneva, and what his plans are for the future of the Finger Lakes. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Joyce, thanks for having me.
I always start these podcasts with an origin question. How and why did you select to come to Hobart and William Smith Colleges?
That's a good question because I didn't. And the story is, you know, I'm from Geneva, born and raised, and I was at that stage of my life in high school where I just wanted to leave. I live across from Boswell Field. That's where I grew up. And so when it came time to choose a college, you know, I had a bunch in front of me. And the story is I was actually down at my uncle's place, Pinky's Restaurant. And that was a place for our family to be every Friday night and others, and really a community sort of thing. And my father said to me, hey, there's someone over there who wants to talk to you. So I walked over and, you know, sat with him, and I didn't know who he was. And he asked me pretty much point blank, why not Hobart? He goes, your cousin's here, your grandfather went here, you've got an uncle that went here. He goes, why not? And I was pretty honest with him. I said, I don't want to be in Geneva. So he said, look, he goes, why don't you come to my office? And he talked a little bit about the family, and he pulled a little bit on the string of, you know, legacy and tradition. And he said, come to my office on Monday. Okay. So he wrote it down for me, tore it off the placemat, and I went home, and Dad said, do you have a good conversation? Sure, I'm going to go see him on Monday. Good. Monday comes around, I put on a sweater, jeans, sneakers, get on my 10-speed bike, and ride over to what I thought was the right address, but it really wasn't. So a security guard very kindly brought me into the building, showed me where I was going. I'm looking up, I look at the door, and I sort of squint, and I go, this can't be. So I go through the door. And sure enough, I walk in and it's Carol Brewster. He's the then president of the colleges. So he said, come on in here and sit down. He sat with me for almost an hour to talk to me about life here and why it's not Geneva. It is and it isn't. This is so much greater and so much more than that. And he convinced me. So I give credit to him.
So this is telling me I should hang out at Pinky's more often to recruit more students for Hobart and William Smith, apparently.
Maybe.
I'll take that in mind. So once you got here, what was your education like here?
Well, this is where, and this is the joy and beauty of what is a liberal arts education. I sort of knew what it was, but I really didn't. And I know it's something that's almost perpetually being defined by people and differently by people. And I think that's the beauty of it. But the education of here just, I think of it as a way that taught me to think. It engaged me in discussion, in debate, in discourse, but also in a relationship with people, with professors, students alike, with people from outside who graduated, who are coming back to give lectures or discussions on where what they were doing with their lives. And just the education itself, I mean, I still remember trembling, you know, in Maynard Smith's philosophy class, because it's probably one of the most enjoyable yet most difficult classes I had, yet pulled so much from it. Not that I can quote Socrates, that's not my intention, but certainly thinking about the way others thought throughout time and why. But carrying that forward really with that capacity, that, and I think about the American Studies with Eric Patterson and Lee Quimby, I think of all these others who really helped me open my eyes to so many different things. So it meant so much because it gave me that capacity to question, to think. And also to take my natural inclination to do, right? So I thought it was a great combination for me.
Well, you are like a walking advertisement for liberal arts then. And that's partly because you also were very successful after leaving here. Could you talk about the career you started in when you graduated from Hobart?
So this is where, you know, it's interesting. I'm going to sort of probably link what I thought then and where I am now. And a lot of it's credited to what it is I pulled and got from Hobart and William Smith Colleges. But I look at it that when I left, it's another story. I had a degree in American Studies, right? And I wanted to be a lawyer or a politician or something like that at the time. But I went down with a fellow Hobart student for the first time to New York City and decided after my first like stepping over various individuals and Port Authority and walking through the city and literally grinning ear to ear that I had to be here. I had to be in this city. And so Scott O'Sullivan, it was him and his family I was had the honor of being taken to New York City with. I wanted to do it. And then I started thinking, well, what am I going to do here? And it had to be finance because I love that concept or that idea. And John Preston, amongst others, and there are several people here, but John Preston, whose son also Jake graduated from here a few years back, he was one of many, but he in particular would say, come into my office. He sat there and would help me network to go get meetings with people just to talk to them. What do you do? What's the best way to get here? What should I be thinking about when it means getting into the financial services industry? And I ended up finding a connection with the help of John, but also with the help of Career Services here, finding Christopher Martin, another grad in the, who worked for then Chase. And I interviewed there for a job, and Chris helped me through the process, and I got hired. And that started my whole career. So the colleges were completely intertwined with that.
Clearly. That's great. That's a great story. Now, eventually, though, you retired from finance. So what prompted that move, and why did you come back to your hometown of Geneva?
So this is where it gets interesting. I look at this as I'm through the first half of my life, right? The other half ends in something that you start to think about more and more. It's not a crisis. This isn't a crisis conversation by any sense of the words. But I think about, Joyce, that when I made that decision to take a job with Chase and then follow that career, it was sort of like getting on an elevator. And I think about professional careers like doctoring, lawyering, banking, finance. These are really good, noble careers that follow typically a corporate path. And I equate it to an elevator. You get in at the bottom, you work your way up, or you come down, or you get off. And one of the things I discovered through that is, you know, I really wasn't telling my own story. I wasn't creating my own story. And I wondered why more and more increasingly I wasn't feeling great about what I was doing, because on paper, I mean, this I think is what I would have aspired to, more than I would have aspired to when I graduated the colleges. I was blessed and honored with where I had achieved and where I made it to. But I still felt like I was going up an elevator or standing still, coming down a little bit, but it wasn't my elevator. I wasn't telling my story. I wanted to create it. So I quit and decided I needed to figure something else out for this next chapter. So I started thinking about that a lot. Took some time off. It's amazing what it does and means to sort of detangle yourself from a way of thinking, but it's a lot. And started a couple different things here and there, still behaving like a corporate guy. But it really wasn't until I was back home and looking and seeing different things here, the family, the friends, the connections, the community, the colleges included, and just how wonderful it is and what carries along with that are the amazing things that are made here. I decided if I want to create, I want to tell my story. There are a lot of people here who are doing that. So why not help them? Why not create something that helps other creators and bring it so that they can tell their story to others? They can promote their product. They can promote their being. So lo and behold, it started in the basement of my house in Geneva, where I literally put up a sign and I said, open. I had four different companies and I had about, I don't know, 15, 20 products and sort of mixed and matched them. I did it online first because I was going to be the Amazon, right? Quote unquote. And I started that and that's how it all began. But I'll tell you what, it's not the Amazon now. And that was definitely the wrong way of thinking early on, but that's probably a different question or conversation.
Well, I think it's also important to notice that, I mean, I think many people have gone through this process in the pandemic of what really matters, but you did this before the pandemic. So in fact, you started FLX Goods just as the pandemic was really getting started. And could you tell us a little bit about the experience of also being an entrepreneur during a pandemic phase?
Yeah, I think the whole idea of being an entrepreneur and making these decisions, and yeah, this predated COVID, this whole thing, and the lockdown. As a matter of fact, I opened my doors up officially well into COVID, October, actually, when shutdown started in that March. But part of it was, go back to what I was saying earlier about that mindset, that change of thinking, right? What is an entrepreneur? What is an entrepreneur gets, you know, a certain tag that comes with great stuff, but really what it is a mindset underneath and a willingness. I don't want to be defined by others, and I'm me. I had to get to learn who I was. I don't want to be defined by someone else. I don't want to be compared to by anyone else. And I'm not going to react to those criticisms, and I'm not going to hide either from critics and try to sequester myself or cover myself so I'm never criticized. That's something you often learn in corporate life, quite honestly. So I wanted to embrace that. Why? Well, courage. And what does courage mean? It means you're opening yourself up to risk. It means you're opening yourself up to what ultimately will be. And this is the one thing I can guarantee for anyone who wants to go in on their own. You're going to get your butt kicked. Not once, not twice, hundreds of times. Because you're going to make mistake after mistake after mistake. And as long as you keep your vision and your focus, and you're willing to take that risk, you're willing to adjust and to have faith and belief in yourself, then it doesn't matter. So Joyce, I decided when I'm sitting there with my online business in, what was it, April, right? And the pandemic had started, right? And I'm like, do I do this or not? I said to myself, the vision's right. The feeling's right. The purpose is right. I can make this work. So forget the critics who are telling me don't do this. Forget the people who are saying there's no way you should ever try to do this. What? It's a pandemic. Are you nuts? Just do it. So I did.
Well, that was impressive. And I think I love the fact that we try to run an entrepreneurial program at the colleges, because you hear a lot about students these days being afraid of failure. And it's like, when are you need to learn how to handle failure. I think that's what you're saying. And in fact, college is actually a good time to do it as well. So, or afterwards, also good. Now, I think, again, there are a lot of people who dream about quitting their day jobs and starting a business, a store, and they think how, you know, this will be bucolic. But the reality, as you just said, is often different. So how did you identify that this could be a viable business opportunity? And also, what is it like to run multiple businesses?
Yeah, there's a lot in that question. It's a great question. I'd start with the viability question. And for any entrepreneur, it starts with an idea. Ideas mean nothing. They mean a conversation, and they mean that it presents something you think will work, and that's great. And what it comes down to is, it's not just the thinking, it's the planning, the plotting, and the doing again and again and again. You know, first I started with milestones. And thought, oh, I'm going to reach this milestone and that milestone. That really didn't work. Well, I'm going to try it. So I set up, you know, objectives based upon, money and when I'm going to run out. And I'll do it based upon really a pure financial type of thing. Okay. That really didn't work. It became one of, and it's almost too simple, but one of, I'm going to keep my vision on where I wanted to go. And I see the timeline, but it's more of a guidepost. I'm going to keep doing and just jump into it first. And I know making mistakes, I'll just fix them and keep moving it forward. So when I left corporate America, a lot of the stuff I just described is the stuff that haunted me, quite honestly. That was the stuff that I was thinking in a way. So for anyone, I think the first thing is you got to want to do it and want to love yourself and create your own story. Start with something like that and not face the critics, not face, quite honestly, the shame. Shame of self, and I don't mean shame being put to shame by others. I mean the shame that you exhibit on yourself. I look at this as every day I ask myself a couple questions, or at least I fight a couple questions. One is, you know, am I good enough to do this, right? Well, you are, right? But it's good enough. It's good that you can ask yourself that, but you are good enough. So you start with that. Two is knowing that there is, that scarcity is another component here, that is what you're doing or what you're thinking about, someone else does it. Can't ever be done. This won't happen, that sort of thing. You almost are afraid because you can come up with a rational excuse for it not to work. You've got to almost take that and put it aside, right? And then third, and it goes back to what I said earlier about not worrying about others, it's criticism. There's going to be criticism out there because you're putting yourself out there. And you just have to learn to ignore it and to do what it is that you're passionate about. And at this stage of my life, and I'm sure there are lots of others like that are like this, and lots of my friends are like this, we talk about it all the time, taking that jump from a comfortable, nice, you know, job and to something like this, you have to ask yourself, what's going to make me happy for the next 30, 40, 50 years? And that's where you start. So I think I just answered the first part of your question, Joyce, a bit long. But that other piece about multiple businesses and, you know, this all started with the intention of being Finger Lakes Goods and selling the local products and services that are made here. But there was another part to it always about selling wine and spirits that were made here. So actually, they have a common denominator, and that's the underlying operating model whereby they would be acquired, they would be integrated into an operating model, and then sold to people both online and in store. And the whole idea of them being two businesses, which it is, and now a third, is that they all follow a very straightforward, common, simple premise. Made here, promoted elsewhere, of course, but really it's one that connects people to the people who make the stuff, right? Whether it's Lisa Fredrickson and Flint Creek Soap or Stacy and Becky from Cuca Candy Emporium or the Franks for Dr. Constantine. You get to know all these people. And to me, it's about connecting them to people they otherwise don't or can't connect with and enabling that. And that's how I create. So managing these multiple businesses is really taking products that fit in the same underlying operating model. That's how it works.
Yeah, so I think that way they're related, or you could think of as hedging a little bit, too.
A little bit.
So there are rumors going around that you may be starting a cookie business, which would be welcome news. Is there any truth to those rumors?
So Matthew Newsom is a student here. Newcomb. He's a student here. Wonderful, bright student. And he did a podcast with me, and I can see him doing great things, no doubt about it. So we were chatting, and I had actually just bought a cookie company not too long before that podcast. I thought, I'll tell Matthew about it, and we'll chat about it, and it won't be news until, you know, it's done. Or, you know, by the time the podcast gets out, it won't be news. But sure enough, I wasn't ready. So it actually was announced with Matthew on his podcast. But yes, I bought a cookie company, Finger Lakes Cookie Company, out of Geneseo, and their operations. And right now we're in the process of integrating them in. It's the same mission, the same focus. The difference with this, I think, is I'm actually now a manufacturer of a product. And the sites on where that product's going to go are both a part of the narrative here, but also one of taking it national, for sure. But it fits right in within the operating model. It fits right in with the mission, the values. Lori Bush, who owned it, she now works as a part of FLX Group LLC. That's the parent company. And she's incredibly active. And we've even, they've taught me a lot, I would say, not only about mission and purpose, but also the art of giving back, not the art, the reality that we have to give back. And we're integrating a lot of new practices and processes, but more importantly, we're working closely with a couple of nonprofits who are going to be right at the heart of this next big announcement we're preparing.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm waiting for you to, I mean, I'm assuming eventually you're going to have to buy a vineyard too and make your own wine, not just market other people's. I think that's the main business around here.
Probably right.
Probably. You heard it here first. I have to thank you, Jim, sincerely for your service on the President's Leadership Council, and for the many internship opportunities that you have provided to our students. It's my understanding that you worked with Hobart and Wayne students in the entrepreneurship program on some of the research for your business plan. What was that experience like getting help from them?
It was awesome. All of it's awesome. I've had interns for easily 20 years from Hobart and William Smith, and have become friends, lifelong friends with a lot of them who continue on in their roles throughout, right? Think Alex Roberts, and he's doing great, for example, with Whistlepig, and just so many others. And the idea of working with the colleges to continue to give back is very important to me, and I appreciate being involved with the President's Leadership Council and others, and I'm always happy to help out where I can. Tom Drennan and his group and crew and his students, Tom and I chatted about how do we get the students involved, and he was kind enough to help me create a capstone project whereby I took the business plan of Finger Lakes Goods and took out a couple of sections, and we created a capstone project, and the students were fantastic. They came up with product ideas, financials, projections, market strategy, who we should be targeting and why, all this great stuff. And I took a lot of that and integrated it right into my plan, and it's still active to this day.
Oh, wow. That is great. Hopefully when you open new companies, we'll get to do that some more with you.
Absolutely.
Now, you earned your MBA at Duke and you'd studied at NYU, both very large schools. And we talked earlier about liberal arts education, but what distinguishes a liberal arts education from these larger places and what you got from that and what we're getting right there as opposed to right at Hobart and Wayne Smith?
I say this, all three of these experiences offered me and provided me with things that have helped me in my career and in my life, right? And that's, I don't want to be, engage in too much hyperbole, but it helped make me who I am today. And I couldn't be where I am without those today. Probably Duke and Hobart and William Smith in particular. NYU was fantastic in that it provided me with something when as I was getting into the global financial services field, some education and knowledge around taking things globally. So it was very important, but it was also very tactical. Duke's Master of Business Administration and the MBA in Finance similarly taught me a lot of the components around running a financial business, a financial model. Bond math, my God, can't stand it, but I had to learn how to do it, or more importantly, what it meant. A lot of different things about the MBA, I think, taught me how to think about how to look at a financial statement, how to look at a business and a business model. It was very specific and precise to what I was doing. And, I was fortunate enough that my then employer, JP Morgan, sponsored me through it. And, they wanted me to do it because it was more than a check the box, and forgive me for saying that, it was a part of their belief, my belief at the time, this would help propel me to the executive ranks. So it meant a lot. And each one has a different meaning for me, but each of them meant something significant.
Sure. So what are some of the challenges that you face currently as a business owner, especially in an economy that is facing inflation and labor shortages?
And I'm affected by both. The supply chain, add to that. I'm watching prices go up 10-15% fairly regularly. I pass some along, not all. I try to create efficiencies where I can to absorb. It's a very real issue. And it's painful when you hear someone who makes jelly, for example, or jam, and her say, my God, the price of sugar has doubled. And I feel horrible, but I'm going to have to pass along a, 30-cent increase per jar sort of thing. And she was pained saying it because she didn't want to do it, but she sees it and experiences it. And you watch that knock-on effect. The employment thing's interesting. I'm going to go back to what I said earlier about being the Amazon or the Finger Lakes versus something else. And what it is more than the Amazon now is an experience. It's a cause. It's a belief. And when you have that and you create something where people want to be a part of, not a part of a machine, not a part of a process, but a part of a cause, you start hiring differently. And don't get me wrong, I'm short a couple people. And I have some issues with filling some gaps. But the people I have as we're building this, and this may be a new way of thinking, at least for me, it's I'm hiring people who aren't just hires. They're a part of the vision. They're a part of the family. They believe in what we're doing. And when we interview or when I interview and talk to people, I spend more time talking to them about what they care about and why. And if it fits with our narrative and our belief and our vision, that's the right person. And so far we've had, almost no turnover as a result of that. It's really getting the people in. That's the challenge.
Well, that seems to be the feeling nowadays, is people really want to work for a mission-driven enterprise. And so you have to have, and you've got a very clearly articulated mission that makes that easier to say to people. Now, you've known the Finger Lakes much longer than I have, having grown up here. Well, I've only been here 3 years. So what is your favorite place or places here? What experience is essential to, say, my understanding this area better?
I mean, people can't see it, but if you look to the left, you see, you know, Seneca Lake, and you see just the natural beauty of it and everything that comes with it. And the thing I took for granted, it was almost like in New York, right? When I moved to New York, I lived on 32nd and Madison, and I lived like two blocks from the Empire State Building. Yet in the 6 years or so I lived in that apartment, I never went up the Empire State Building once. I didn't see it. Just like here growing up, I really didn't see the lake. I went by it all the time. It was more of a side view, right? And I'm not just saying the lake. I mean, everything you see here as you drive around, and the natural beauty is really, it's beautiful. And I think my favorite part is just driving around and seeing that and allowing myself to take that in is I think a wonderful thing. Two, it's got to be the stuff and the people who are here. You know, I left a meeting just before I came here, and it was all about doing something better for the community. And there wasn't a person in there. They were certainly talking about some of the potential pitfalls of it, but the intention was how to make it work as opposed to how not to make it work. And what a refreshing difference that is. It's not that there are not naysayers, there's plenty of them. But when you start aligning yourself, and there's lots more of them here than are not here, with people who want to get to yes, what a great feeling, a great thing. And it invigorates you. It makes it terrific. And I think, you know, the last thing, and as I look around and I see, you know, everything that's made here and everything I have in my store, I'm going to ask you a question, Joyce. I've got 35 vendors, partners in Finger Lakes Goods, and now 26 wineries in my shop. How many contracts do you think I have?
Don't you have one with each of them?
None.
I feel like this is a trick question.
It is.
Oh,
zero.
None. Wow.
These, they're mostly, if not all, handshake agreements. You put in a purchase order, they bring it to you, you pay for it, they give you, you pay for it on the spot, or you pay for it with some terms. But I don't have one contract, not one. And in corporate life, I would be looked at as a pariah if ever I said, hey, let's bring on X company and we're not going to sign a contract. The difference here is there's still that trust. It's not to say something won't go wrong and I'm not aware of it. They're not aware of it. But that ability to work with each other and to really figure it out really separates it. And it makes it, honestly, one of my favorite places because of that. And it comes back to the people.
Well, we do have contracts at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, sad to say. Well, it's been great.
They're not necessary.
sometimes they might be. So, well, it's been great talking with you, Jim, and I appreciate it. I think I speak for everybody in the area that we're glad you moved back, and thank you for contributing to the area and for all you do for the colleges as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it.